war, celebrity, tragic death, secret London streets, and a family dynasty of mapmakers. Yes, this week's episode really does have everything. We're off to Long Acre in the West End to find out what's behind the name of the map company Stanford's. Oh, and you'll spot it, it's about 6 or 7 minutes in. I mentioned Charing Cross in the context of a rail crash. I, of course, meant Clapham Junction. Anyway, maps at the ready, pith helmets on. Let's go and explore this particular facet of London.
Hey baby, let me take you down. So we'll play some strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, sniff out me. See the beats of the air, land and the sea. Some creep, some saw. Down the road, jam brand store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
Well, hello, hello. Explore, discover, inspire are the words on the wall next to me here at Stanford's. We're on Long Acre, which is just between Leicester Square and Covent Garden. And the name Stanford's might be familiar to you, or you might have yet to discover what Stanford's is. With me to tell us exactly that is David Mantero. He's the senior buyer at Stanford's. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, very good. For those who are uninitiated, what does Stanford's do?
Well, Stanford's is the largest map and travel bookshop in possibly the world. Perhaps not in size, but certainly in the range of stock and the weights of items we carry on. And we help travelers and we sell maps and guidebooks and other accessories.
We're big fans of a map on this show, and I'm hoping that we can explore different ways of conceptualising space, and perhaps particularly London as we head along. But one of the things that Stanford's is renowned for is having an interesting history. It's one of those stores that goes way back, like a Harrods, so we're going to be digging into that too. I wonder if we should start by sketching out what's here and what's going on, how many floors, what's on sale, that kind of thing.
So we have three floors. And basically, we divided it slightly in a geographical way, very loosely. So when you come in, you find first London and local interest and books on the UK and full selection of Ordnance Survey maps. And then we have other things like children's and accessories, as I said, and some stationery. Then if you go upstairs, which is where we are now, we have a historical map section, but also we have what we call the European section, which is maps and books on France, Italy, Spain. Well, you know what Europe is. And then also, quite important, here upstairs on the first floor, we have what we call the digital section, where we can print maps on demand, because basically we are agents of the Ordnance Survey, and we have access to the database. In fact, we are the oldest agents of Ordnance Survey in the country. We have been since 1863. Anyway, so here upstairs you can get maps printed of any location in the UK with your house in the middle, any scale. It's things that people use for planning applications, but also for decoration, gifts, anything.
Well, in fact, as we speak, there's a map of the world being churned out there.
Yeah, in one of those enormous plotters, yes. It is quite exciting, actually, to see the maps coming out. And
Ordnance Survey, my loose understanding of that, well, it's got something to do historically with figuring out where to put artillery and weapons and so forth. It sort of evolved from that, I think.
Basically, and in fact, in the UK, the name still reflects that. But in other countries, it's still the army, the only people that are allowed to map those countries. That's particularly so with Turkey, Greece, even in Spain, is still, even though there's now a civilian survey, the army is still very much involved in actually taking the measurements and doing the actual groundwork.
That's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Well, I suppose in some cases it was. It first started as a question of security, because obviously, you know, the lay of the land is a very important strategical advantage that a country could have in terms of, you know, if there was conflict. But I think with time what's happened is that the resources necessary to map a whole country and keep it updated and constantly surveying, that's really expensive. And the army as it happens, thankfully, it's not been very busy in the last few years in Europe.
They would love to hear you say that.
So they've had, it's a use to give to them, which is, I suppose, good for the country and everybody.
Well,
better than fighting, I guess.
Better than fighting, yes.
Yes.
It does surprise me because, I was going to leave this until perhaps later on in the conversation, but it seems to me that technology is moving ahead of pace, and there must be, whilst I can understand it's a difficult, detailed job, it must be that there are other companies out there with satellite technology or whatever who are able to map things increasingly easily.
Yes, of course. Yeah, it's just only when it comes to the closer detail, when even at the level of civil engineering of new buildings, small buildings, even vegetation, things like that. It's sometimes you need to double check and actually see exactly what's there. I mean, the satellite can give you quite a lot, and in fact, that's most of the mapping nowadays for people. But they still need to do some surveying of. As you say, it's really changed a lot in recent years. But some countries are really, really behind at the same time. So lots of things are still almost made by hand.
We will certainly be coming back to that, I think, because there's a big conversation there. One of the things that struck me, and of course we've been in contact as we've been setting up the interview and so forth, there are some organisations where you can tell that they're extremely used to having people with microphones wandering in and out all the time. I get the impression that it's not quite so much the case here, and I wonder whether that's an accurate perception and whether that's a choice on the part of the company.
Well, there's been in the past some filming crews and we get, it's just perhaps as a bookseller, we are, and my colleagues and me, we are quite shy and introverted, and it's not our strength, perhaps, public speaking. talking about film crews, famously, Around the World in 80 Days with Michael Palin started here at Stanford. So the beginning, the opening of that series was Michael Palin choosing maps for his journey here. And we very often, as I said, there's film crews filming just pieces of the news in front of a particular map. But yes, as I said, it's not normally us that appear in the films. It's people prefer to see Michael Palin, I guess.
If I remember rightly, I think I remember that Michael Palin's journey was due to end with them coming back from, I want to say, Southampton, on a train that ended up being involved in the Charing Cross rail disaster. And it was by some small piece of luck that they decided not to be on that train. I don't know if my memory is working properly there or not. That's interesting that you identify as booksellers, and clearly a portion of what you sell is books, but a lot of what we're surrounded by at the moment are those kind of foldable maps that fathers have spread over their dashboard on family holidays.
Yes, no, I suppose bookselling is it's a name, and in fact, this is a really good point. It happens really often to me that outside work, I describe myself as a bookseller. Or I say, when people ask, what do you do? I say, I work in a bookshop in Covent Garden. And people will put a face and say, which one? And I say, Stanford's. They don't always understand the name or recognize the name. But if I say the map shop, they always say, oh, yes, yes. So you really touch a point. And in fact, yes, I mean, we are all passionate about maps, and that's what drove most of us here. And in fact, guidebooks were a fairly recent thing. Fairly recent, I say, because of the history of the company being 160 years, but I'm probably talking about the 1930s.
Oh, right, as recently as that. What is it about maps? Because it does seem to me that maps do ignite a passion in certain people, and I mean, I enjoy a map as much as the next man, but and it is men particularly, I think. I don't know if that's a fair understanding of it. Certainly we've had mapping exhibitions as part of Londonist. We often speak to UCL and their department that deals with representations of space. What is it about maps that you're into?
Okay, good question. I suppose apart from being a representation of space and things, as much a they say a lot about the people that made them and the society that created them. And I just find it really interesting looking at a map and trying to understand the person or the society that map came from, and all the ideas and personalities that are behind all these maps. And in fact, you can see lots of maps that are less concerned with the accuracy of the representation that they make, but it's more about themes. And I'm also really interested on those kind of maps which are not necessarily about geography or not about physical geography, but much more about maybe a social geography or a you know, even a personal level, there's some about, I saw recently a map somebody made about, which shows the distances in walking minutes from somebody's house to all the things that he does. And I thought it was fascinating.
That's a great idea. I remember there's, I saw a map of the world, the title of it was something like Map of the World as Seen by English People. And you've got England as this enormous country in the middle of the globe, and then right next to it, the USA, and then a very long way away, France, tiny and distant. But maybe we need to develop that idea a little bit more, though, because what we started out by saying was we were talking about Ordnance Survey and military mapping, and that seems very different from what you've just described with personalities being infused into it. So how does that work? How does that mismatch get explained?
Well, the funny thing is that personalities have always been involved in mapping and maps. And in fact, recently somebody showed me a map of the one of the Ordnance Survey maps where the person that drew it actually wrote his name. It's slightly hidden. It's written where basically what he's used is the symbols that you use to put rocks on the coastline. He's actually turned them into his name. And you have to look at it upside down. I mean, all these things happen in the most serious maps. And in fact, the army and people like that use things like this to take care of their copyright. There is streets that don't exist in most A to Zs and street maps in the world. And it's basically a way that map makers have to control to see who is using their mapping without paying the price, I suppose.
That's incredible.
Yes, no, it's when I was first told, it's fascinating, actually.
Do we know of any roads in London that don't exist?
Well, the thing is, it changes, but yes, actually, what you have to do is come here to Stamford and maybe ask one of my colleagues and spend some time on we have a big, big map of London in the floor downstairs, which is worth visiting, and perhaps if you ask one of our colleagues, we can find one of the small cul-de-sacs that actually are not there.
Wow, okay. And what about you? You've been here something like 10 years.
Yes, it was 10 years last September, I think. Yes, no, I originally from Spain, probably can't tell, from Malaga. And yes, I arrived to London about 13 years ago. And at some point, I had a friend that was working here, and I was really interested and passionate about maps, and I started in the post room. And yes, so 10 years after, yeah.
Now you're the senior buyer.
Well, yes.
What does that involve then? What's your day-to-day?
Well, basically, it's sort of controlling the stock and making sure that we have what we need to have and choosing books and I suppose, curating the selection of items that we have, but also making sure that we don't run short of important things that, you know, our customers need.
Yes, one of the things that struck me, and it should have been obvious, I don't know why it wasn't, is that this is a seasonal game.
Really, really, really much so. And in fact, it happens generally to retailers that for them, December and November, sort of the Christmas period, represents a huge proportion of what they do, which is not quite so much for us, because we do have the element of June, July and August, really high peak on maps and travel books, and as you can imagine, I mean, it's holiday time. So
this is the bulk of that business then is people who are going away and they grab a map as they go, rather than kind of planning and well ahead or something?
Well, no, the thing is, I suppose there's two elements to it. What happens in summer is that the traveller that we get is more short haul, as we call it. So people that are going to France or Spain, which perhaps doesn't need that much preparation because they are familiar with the place, or they've been before, they even might have a house there, and they just come to pick bits and pieces just maybe a week or 2 weeks before they go. And then in November and October you see the long haul traveller, which actually starts in September probably. People are starting to look at maybe when they're going to go in December to India or Thailand or anywhere really. So yes, it is really much seasonal, but there's even within that seasonality there's different elements. So we have peaks both in winter and in summer, but they're completely different travellers and different needs, kind of.
So the profile of your customers is evolving over the year?
Yes. Yes. Or potentially they're the same people, in fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Seems to be, I could be completely wrong, but the kind of place that inspires loyalty among its customers. Do you have a lot of people who are in here all the time?
Yes, very much so. Some of them even famous.
You've given me the perfect lead-in, because I was looking through your list of renowned traveller customers. I'll let you do the bragging.
No. Well, I don't want to either expose people or anything like that.
Well, most of them are dead, the ones I was looking at, in fairness.
Yes, of course, yeah. Well, I mean, in that sense, Stanford has really close relationship with people like Scott or, Captain Scott. And there's even correspondence between him and the founder of the company, as well as Stanford, talking about maps of the expedition and how, in fact, Scott took exception because Shackleton's name was also mentioned in the same map, and he didn't think it had to be. And it's actually quite funny in a way. But there's been other people, Florence Nightingale, and again, there's correspondence, and there's who else?
I saw Amy Johnson on the list.
Yes. Anyway, and closer to the day, closer to now, we've seen Bill Clinton here. We've seen Brad Pitt. We see Michael Palin very often. He works very near here, and Nicholas Crane and Paul Theroux. Basically, if anybody's just remotely interested in travel, they tend to pass through here.
There's one contentious name on the list. Sherlock Holmes.
Mm.
Surely we have a problem with that claim.
Yes, and in fact, he himself didn't make it here, even in figurative terms.
Now, why is he on your website as being a customer?
Yes, well, basically, in the Hound of the Baskervilles, there is a section where Sherlock Holmes sends one of his kids, street kids, to buy some maps from Stanford for him to go to the malls and, you know. So a high, very detailed map of the mountain. That's basically where the claim comes from. So, Stanford is mentioned in the Hound of the Baskervilles, and I guess, in the manner of speaking, Sherlock Holmes' shop here. Yes,
that's pretty impressive credentials.
It is. I'm pretty sure the name of Stanford is appearing in other books, other fiction. Recently, I can think of Her Fearful Symmetry. By the writer that wrote The Time Traveler's Wife, Niffenegger.
Audrey?
Audrey Niffenegger, yes.
Yeah.
And she's a big fan of the shop. And so the shop appears in, is mentioned in her second book, which actually is based in London.
I want to know what Florence Nightingale wanted a map of, do we know?
We'll have to find out. actually, I don't. Mm. I don't know now.
That takes us back a long way. I mean, that must be getting on to the earliest days of the store. How did the store get established?
Yeah, well, basically, it all started in 1853, basically about 161 years ago. To start with, it actually, there was somebody else called Saunders who had a stationer's and map shop in what's now really Trafalgar Square. But at the time was still part of the Strand. And then the then young Edward Stanford sort of joined the company with him, just working as a cartographer. And then soon transpired that Saunders wanted to sell and move on. And then Stanford's established in those premises. As I said, that's 1853. And then quite quickly, actually, Stanford's established himself as a name for maps and map making, and in fact he started what I just mentioned earlier, this partnership with Ordnance Survey, where Stanford was actually the sole agent of Ordnance Survey. So if anybody, even other shops, wanted to buy Ordnance Survey maps, they had to buy them through Stanford.
It's dangerously close to being a monopoly, isn't it?
Yes, I think the problem was more that at the time the Ordnance Survey wasn't interested in getting involved with trade, so they didn't want to have a commercial arm, so to speak. So they made the maps, and that was as much as they wanted to get involved in it. They needed somebody to distribute the maps for them and take them around. It did create a lot of overtime, not at the beginning, but over time other people started to say that it was, complain that it was a monopoly and then it was against free trade, etc. But as I say, it started more because of a necessity.
That brings up a couple of ideas for me. One of them is that 53, that must be round about the time of the railways appearing, mustn't it? Was that sort of influencing the growth in maps?
Yes. In fact, I forgot to say that. I was going to say, and that's why Stanford's actually, the business that Stanford started became so successful so quickly. It's because of the... basically how the Victorian society was and all the advances that were happening. But yes, it's basically having the railways meant that the travelling and the people, the kind of trips that before maybe somebody had to organise with coaches and months ahead and that kind of thing, suddenly was available for everybody and quite affordably. And it meant that you could cover more terrain in less time. But also the idea that the world was closer to hand just arose curiosity in people. And there were more narratives of places and voyages and people having been to places. So I think, in general, the society suddenly was interested in maps and books about travelling and faraway places and that kind of thing.
Oh, right, yes, because there's the Victorian Explorer is a character that we all recognise. And, of course, Stanford was establishing his business next to one of the big rail hubs at Charing Cross.
Of course, yes. In fact, I think at the time, Trafalgar Square and Charing Cross was a hub in general for not just travelling, but I think politics and basically all the societies, the Royal Societies near there. It was basically a great place to be at the time.
The other question, of course, is if that was the period when Ordnance Survey started licensing Stanford's, what was the general public using by way of finding their way around before then?
Well, what happens, Stanford's wasn't really the only map maker at the time, nor was the Ordnance Survey. There were other people, like names that we still recognise, like Phillips or Bartholomew. Phillips was a map maker based in Liverpool, I believe, and Bartholomew was in Edinburgh, but they all made different maps of different parts of the country and cities and places like that. And even before that, there were other map makers.
Were they stitching them together? I mean, presumably if people couldn't get around as easily or get as far, then there wouldn't be as much need, but was anybody stitching them into maps of the entire country or anything like that at that point?
Actually, to be honest, I wouldn't know.
No. Oh, it'd be interesting to get to say. I can't imagine there'd be a requirement because nobody's going to be driving up to Scotland or something, are they?
Yes, no, I mean, it would be more like, I suppose, for general interest. And John Ruskin writing to Stanford says, "Gentlemen, have you any school atlas or any other sort of atlas on sale at present without railroads in its maps? Of all the entirely odd stupidities of modern education, railroads in maps are the infinitely oddest to my mind. Ever your faithful servant and victim, John Ruskin."
What was his beef?
I suppose it's he was... by that time, he had retired to the countryside and he pretty much saw the... rail travel and the rails as an intrusion into the quiet, beautiful British landscape, I suppose.
So this is a grumpy old man in Buckinghamshire fed up with HS2.
But it does show that there is the were maps and map making before the railways came up, and yes, and demand for it, I suppose.
Well, we've got the life story of Stanford's as a business and indeed the remainder of Mr. Stanford's life to come. We'll also be talking about digitisation and digital methods of finding your way around and war and all of that coming up in the second part of today's show, which we interrupt for a message from our sponsor.
Having an annual travel card is good. Your travel is sorted for the year with no queuing at ticket offices, no getting caught out with an expired ticket and a hefty discount on buying monthly tickets. Plus, there are other benefits, like cheaper UK rail travel and 2-for-1 deals on London stuff. However, not all of us have employers who can give us a season ticket loan, and few of us can afford to pay thousands of pounds up front to get one. Now, there is another way. Commuter Club gives you access to the big discounts offered by annual travel cards, while keeping all the flexibility of buying monthly tickets. Join Commuter Club, and you'll make 11 payments at the same cost as a monthly travel card, including their 5.6% interest rate, for a full year of travel. Best of all, with Commuter Club, there is no lock-up or cancellation fees. So, what will you do with the money you save?
Find out more and sign up to start saving at www.commuterclub.co.uk/Londonist.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe. I'm with David Mantero, who's the senior buyer here at Stamford's. And, well, we've been talking while the commercial was playing about historical mapping. And, David, not really your bag, the historical mapping. So your focus is very much on the more modern. And by more modern, we're talking the last 150 or so years. I've got one mapping anecdote and only one mapping anecdote. I don't know whether this is apocryphal, but I've got a story about the word, you know, the word dicey, which can mean when something's unreliable or untrustworthy or something like this. And my understanding is that that comes from the maps made by a map maker called Dice. And this was back in the day. I'm not sure how many hundred years we're going back, but it was probably before we knew about the entire shape of America. So, you know, there'd be monsters here and those kind of details on the map. But apparently his maps were notoriously unreliable. So if something was unreliable, it was dicey. So there we go. That's my map fact for the day. Let's come to the more modern history of mapping. And we started the story of the company in 1853, and we were down in Charing Cross. Well, I suppose the question is, what happened next?
Yes, well, basically, so that was the first Edward Stamford. There were, in fact, two, father and son. And so the first Edward Stamford retired in the year 1885, I think, and then Edward Stamford Jr., I suppose, took over from him, and those actually were the really the heyday of Stamford's, and as it was indeed the best part of the Victorian Britain, and you know, there were prosperous times. And eventually Stamford's had to move twice because of the changing landscape of what now is actually
Admiralty Arch?
Yeah, Admiralty Arch. Well, basically that's where the site of the original Stamford was, and so they had to move. And then eventually they moved to a site very near there, in what's Cockpool Street. You can still see the building that Stamford's commissioned. It's above, I think it's Garfunkel's now or something like that. But the building still has all the details that Stamford had commissioned for it. So there's an atlas holding the globe, and it's actually quite beautiful. Was a quick visit. So then there Stamford's prospered and was based pretty much until 1901. All throughout that time, because of the relationship with Southern and Survey and the amount of stock that Stamford had to keep to be a distributor for them, Edward Stamford had the second, or junior, purchased some buildings in what is where we are now, basically, in Longacre. But back then, it wasn't really a commercial street in any possible way. So he had basically the printing house and some warehouse in this very site, pretty much. And eventually, when he was forced to move again from Cockburn Street, because I think the building was forcibly purchased by the London Authority at the time to have their offices, I believe. Stamford's had no option, and they moved here, which at the time was seen as a difficult move in a way, because, as I said, this wasn't really a commercial street, and it was pretty much a, I believe it's where people used to make carts and sell carts, and there were showrooms for you know, hansoms and that kind of thing.
So that must have risked destroying the business.
It was a difficult decision, I believe, but it seems like by then Stamford's had this reputation and following and loyalty from its customers that decided to come here and turn into the place to be, and so not being in Cockpit Street wasn't that important anymore.
I suppose if there's one customer base that you would want if you're going to a slightly out of the way location, it would be travellers.
Yes, and explorers, yeah. And people that can find their way.
So, I mean, maybe I'm jumping to conclusions here, but to what extent was having Stamford's in this street responsible for the street being what it is now? Is it too much of a leap to suggest that some of this other stuff grew up around it?
It's possibly. It is difficult. So I wouldn't, because obviously, because also lots of things change and it changed again and changed again. I think the war probably has a lot to do with that too. I think in a way, Stamford actually was lucky to be here, the way things pan out in the end, in the last 20 years. Before the last 20 years, it was this area was still actually not that, commercially, it wasn't that popular, I wouldn't say. you know, when the, or maybe I should say 30 years, when the market was still the market, and, you know, it wasn't really the shopping destination that you have now.
You mentioned the war. Which war are we referring to?
Well, both wars, I suppose. Basically, the first war, in a way, something strange happened with the Stanfords, and in that, both wars were really, really terrible for the Stanfords at two levels. One of them was business, which it was, I'm sure, for everybody, because of all the restrictions and all the and the men that couldn't be here, and, you know, the disruption to travel in particular, that was bad for Stanfords. But also, as it happens, during the First World War is when Edward Stanford Jr. died, just on the last year of the war, before the actual end of it. And as it happens, his son that took over died the year before the end of the Second World War. And both of those things really marked the history of the company in a way. Firstly, because I think the second Edward Stanford probably was the last family member that was properly really interested in mapping and cartography, and it would seem that his sons were much more military men, and in fact they all fought in the Great War, and they all survived, luckily enough, even though being in the, you know, the front and everything. But then once that Edward Stanford Jr. died, his son took over, but it really became obvious that it wasn't his main interest to be a businessman, I suppose, really. Although he did a good job, and he managed to keep the Stanfords going until the Second World War came about. This is C.K. Stanford, I think. That was his name. Or I think it was Colonel Stanford.
Sorry, Colonel Stanford?
Colonel Stanford, I think. That's what they called him here.
Really?
In the shop. And the thing is, he was... I said that he wasn't interested in cartography, but that's not true in a way. I mean, he was interested in cartography, but much more from a military point of view. So he assisted the government in mapping the really secret maps he was making from a cell in jail. He was going there in the evenings and closing himself in there and just mapping for the D-Day landings, basically.
Were there restrictions? Because I know that one of the things that the country did to try and foil any potential invasion was remove all the street signs. And I'm wondering how having a shop full of maps of the country fared in that.
Yep, not full restriction on selling maps of the country, yes. No, I mean, as I said, for the business, it was a terrible, terrible year during the war. Not just because of the disruption to travel and to general trade, but because, in fact, it was forbidden to sell ordnance survey maps and to make them available to other people.
This company's had a hard time at various points in its history.
Well, I suppose it's a long history, so, and if you live through two wars, you're bound to have some hard time.
Yeah, right. This was the colonel who died just before the end of the Second War?
Yes, and then his younger brother took over.
Oh, hang on though. Does that mean that he did or didn't get to witness the D-Day landings?
He didn't, I'm afraid, no. He didn't get to witness, what people did with his maps or the use that we were put to. It's a sad thing. And then his brother took over, and his brother, who had fought also in the Second World War, actually in the front, by the time that he came back from the war, he really was not just keen on being a businessman. He was actually not really keen on living in the... living in the city and that kind of thing. He really wanted to move out and not have the responsibilities. And so that's a very important time in the company. I think it was 1950-51, where Stanfords was basically sold to one of the map-making companies that I mentioned before, Philips. And that's that inaugurates a completely different time for the history of Stanfords and what Stanfords becomes. Because until that point, really... Or perhaps until before the Second World War, Stanford was still a map maker, in essence, not just a map retailer or a travel shop or whatever we are now. But from the Second World War onwards, really the publishing program sort of stopped. Firstly, because there was no demand for it, but then because, as I said, the sons of Edward Stanford weren't necessarily interested in that world and and perhaps didn't have the vision to drive the company through those times.
And how long did Philips continue to own the firm?
Yeah, well, then, so Philips owned the firm until 1980, I believe.
That's got to be a good time, sort of 60s in particular. There was a lot of growth in holidays, wasn't there?
Yes, yes, but perhaps not quite as strong as it then became with, you know, after the 70s and during the 80s. And in fact, I think possibly the highest point was as recent as 2005-04, when, you know, really, really cheap, affordable airline fares became widespread, and particularly in European travel and short, you know, short breaks and the whole concept of all of that. And I think that's when suddenly, I'm jumping here, I'm going too far ahead. Maybe I should talk to him about those years. The 60s,
I don't know.
70s. Not that I know that much about it, but yes, it's. But I suppose during that time, it was more European travel, and in fact, the reason why Philips was in a position to buy Stamfos, and the reason why Stamfos sort of lost a bit influence or its position in the mapping world is because they failed to realize that UK travel had become something really important, and people like Philips and Bartholomew actually started creating county maps and city plans for the whole of the UK, and because in the post-war years, I think UK travel was a thing. People weren't going to Europe quite so much. But then, as a result of this, you know, once for a few years, Stamfos perhaps was a bit lost after not being stopped being a map maker. But then it found its identity in being a supplier of maps, and basically, without realizing, it became a hub of cartographic knowledge, I suppose. Where basically, lots of people knew a lot about maps and where to source them, and I think nobody realized until it had happened that this was a place suddenly to come and find maps of anywhere that were very difficult to find anywhere else. And so Stamfos became a specialist in sourcing those kind of maps and in getting travel books also and narrative, and it becomes kind of like a hub for travelers rather than a map maker, which it had been before.
I suppose we can't really keep going down this road without hitting the question of the future. I know we've got some of the much more up-to-date history to talk about, but the elephant in the room is Google and those maps that can appear on your phone. And I'm working in literary fiction. I'm very happy to support an industry that on paper doesn't look like it should work or has got fierce competition from other things. But what's been the effect on business from those sort of things, Google Maps and so forth?
Well, it's difficult to tell in a way. I mean, it obviously, I cannot say that it doesn't affect, and it has a huge effect. And in fact, we've seen decline in sales of street plans. That's completely undeniable. I myself, everybody, I think you can't deny the how handy it is to have you know, your maps in your phone, and you just check them whenever you want with your location on it, and it's great. It's extremely useful. The thing is, Google Maps and Google Earth and programs like that, I think, have had a double effect. So some people might not be mind maps so much because they can check things online, perhaps. But at the same time, I think it's fomenting some interest that perhaps wasn't there before. People that might have never been exposed to maps now are exposed to maps, and they might become a new generation of people that actually want to then see what the thing is, you know, the actual piece of paper or even, you know, come here and get something printed for them in the site center, or see what else is available, what used to be available, you know, old maps of the places that they can look at now. So potential, the potential is that actually, well, we could think as an enemy, it, to an extent it can be actually more supportive than you would think. Yeah, that's
Yes, because I suppose, and it's going to be enabling your business to sell online and things like that. And the other thing, and I say this, maybe I like physical objects, I like paper, but part of that is because if your battery goes, or if you drop your tablet down a toilet or whatever, then suddenly whatever is on there is gone. Or if you've got no signal for whatever reason, a paper thing can be quite handy, especially, I guess, if you're traveling in a remote region.
Yes, no, and not only that, also...
But the Midlands or something.
Yes, yes. I was with Brecon Beacon, so... no, the thing is, one thing the maps give you that sometimes, you know, other devices don't, is an overview of the context where you are. So when you look at a device, you can see where you are, and the very, you know, the points are very close to you in a map. You can look at that because it's there, but you can also see other, you know, where you are within the context of everything. So you know, you're driving from here to there, but what's to your left or your right, or what other places are close to you, or you know, have you passed next to the coast and you might not have even realized, or you know. I've met people that have been to Mallorca and didn't realize they were in an island.
What? For real?
Yes, for real. I mean, they weren't the most intelligent people in the world, but it's, I mean, it happened to them. And, you know, they were driving in a car with one of these GPS unit things. And, of course, the GPS unit doesn't tell you that you're in an island. You just see the road ahead and there's always land. So.
Technology at work.
So I must say also that, you know, we are not staying put, and we are actually investing in the future, and we have embraced the present, I should say. And we have a business-to-business division, which... what they've done is they're using digital mapping to create a service where if you have a company or housing association or things like that, they can put data onto the maps and use it to manage the businesses and the... it's actually very clever, and I hardly understand it.
Well, yeah, I'm struggling to... What sort of data might we be talking about?
So basically, if for a housing association, for example, they buy a piece of data where all of the different buildings might be, and then they can overlay with data on the costs, on the repairs that are needed, on the... pretty much anything.
Oh, so this could be like those Booth's poverty maps.
Yes, but in a very, very modern way, where you have layers and layers within the same one map that you can manipulate and change constantly, yeah.
What else are you seeing in terms of innovation? What are you seeing as buyer that's coming through that's exciting you? Or is mapping a very, very constant area?
No. I mean, it's... I think what I've seen recently, funny enough, is a revival of old maps, and I think there's a nostalgic element in recent years. The availability of antique mapping and reproductions of old maps, like the Booth's poverty map that you just mentioned. When I first started here in Stamford, very few people knew of the Booth's poverty map, and we would sell a couple of copies a day. But recently it was in television, and it's got really, really popular. But at the same time, there's hundreds of new maps that are sort of coming out of archives and coming back to life. And I think that is one of the biggest trends at the moment, actually. And also how maps are being used a lot for decoration and as sort of like a lifestyle choice. It's a strange thing, but as I said, there's, as we were talking about before, there's lots of people passionate about maps, and I think maps are more than just something they use. It's something that they have in their lives, so to speak.
We're coming towards the top of the programme. I wondered if I could ask you to take me to one or two of the items that excite you most, or that you're proudest of selling here at Stamford.
One of the things that we have been concentrating a little bit of late, because we're trying to recover the heritage of the company, which maybe in the last few years has been not so much lost, but perhaps a little... out of focus, or it hasn't been the focus of the company perhaps of the last few years, and But we've decided now to perhaps bring it back to life and make sure that people are aware of who we have been and what the history of the company was. And so one of the things that we've done is in conjunction with the Royal Geographical Society, who have a magnificent library that I recommend to anybody to go and visit in Kensington Gore. I think they might let you go and visit and show you around. They don't only have maps and books, they also have curiosities like Livingstone's chair and Ptolemy Atlas. Is absolutely fantastic, absolutely incredible. Anyway, they happen to have lots of maps that were made by Stanfors back in 1860s, 1870s. It's a huge archive. Sadly, we didn't keep an archive here in the shop. So we've been there, we've discovered these maps, and we are starting to print them here ourselves. And I think it's I find them fascinating. I think it's a great thing to have and to be able to bring back and show people all these maps that were made back in time. And they were basically the most, some of the most impressive things at the time.
We're looking at a couple of map display units right now. Can we go back to this one here, the Eastern Hemisphere in one circle, and then a companion page poster, the Western Hemisphere, and let's see what the differences are. There's a big country called Arabia on this one.
Well, you do have, this is 1888, and you do have these mountains here, for example, are quite fun. That's the Kong Mountains, which don't exist. And in fact,
what?
they don't exist at all. And at the time, they were pretty much a myth. But nobody had explored that part properly at the time. And they had been mentioned by somebody in the book. And there they are. And they appear in most of the maps of the time. maps are full of these quirks and wonderful things. I'm pretty sure there's some island somewhere that don't exist, never existed. And they stayed in maps until as late as the 70s, I think. Absolutely fascinating. Apart from this,
Is there a convention on? Is there any convention on which country goes in the middle of the map?
Not really. I suppose maps are always cut in one of the two big oceans. I suppose just so you can keep the land all together. You don't have to break continents or things like that. So generally, they are either Pacific Centre or Atlantic Centre.
So it's going to be American-centric or Europe-centric?
Pretty much. Or actually, I wouldn't... I think China would make it more in the middle, if in a Pacific Centre one, perhaps. So or Australia, in fact. Australia makes it really to the middle in a Pacific Centre. Map projections are a fascinating subject in themselves. I'm sure you know the Peters projection map. It's basically all these maps, flat maps in particular, are always an interpretation of something that originally was round, and it always going to distort what you have in one way or another. The traditional way is to distort it in size in order to keep the shape of the continents the same as you see on the globe. But then Peters was cartographer that wanted to show how maps had been showing a view of the world that perhaps could be associated with a Eurocentric or the Western world being sort of the center of the world, so to speak. America, the US, the UK, Europe in general. And what he did is he did a completely different version of a map, where what he did is be true to the relative size of the countries while distorting the shapes. And then you can see how Brazil, for example, is much bigger than you would normally see it in another map. And
I should explain, what we're looking at is a map of the world, and essentially anything in the northern hemisphere is squashed flatter. Canada is about the same height in totality as the United States. Mexico is much longer than both of them, and Brazil twice the size of either of them. Russia's a big flat pancake at the top. Australia's a dangly thing.
It's just try to show how, Africa and South America, in fact, in landmass are much bigger than we normally keep in mind, and you can see how this could have political and you know, socioeconomic significance.
Yes, I can. The national psychology has got to be altered by this, hasn't it?
Yes, completely.
Well, there's lots to look at here, and an entire shop's worth of maps and guide. We haven't even touched guidebooks. There's a whole other episode. We have to drift away and go on our travels. For those curious to find out more, we should probably name the address and give the website and all that jazz.
Yes, of course. Well, the website is www.stanfords, with an N and an F, stanfords.co.uk. And you can find us in London. We are at 12 to 14 Long Acre, which is basically bang in the middle between Leicester Square Station and Covent Garden Station. And you can find us in Bristol in 29 Corn Street.
Word of advice if you're coming via Covent Garden Tube. I rather foolhardily decided not to wait for the elevators and did the 193 steps before doing this interview. It's only by a close shave that we managed to do the interview at all. I don't know that I'm going to be able to ascend any stairs today.
Yeah, I recommend Leicester Square generally.
David Montero, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming. My heart aches for some far off
place. No one could have left you with your name. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to David Mantera. Thanks to Becca Evans, Bernie Barclay, and Mark Barr. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. Front door.